That's Bruce Springsteen from 2002. The song is Further On Up the Road. Powerful tune, dark imagery. It kind of sets the tone for where we're heading from here into the program tonight. I know, as I mentioned at the beginning of tonight's discussion, I'm not really a student of 9/11 alternate theories, but when I heard that Joseph Farrell was tackling 9/11, I knew I had to dive in because, you know, my experience reading his stuff, he's known for his scholarship, meticulous research, and especially known for spotting patterns and connections that other researchers have failed to spot. And every one of the previous books by him that I've read have amazed and frightened me. It's disturbing stuff. And if you'd asked me 5 years ago what I think about a Nazi connection to modern UFO sightings, I would have been highly skeptical. I mean, sure, the Nazis had some UFO designs in mind, but, you know, that ended with the collapse of the Third Reich and they're all gone. Old men, and there's nothing left. But my view has changed. And after reading this latest book, which is called Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery, The Fascist International 9/11 and Penetrated Operations by Joseph Farrell, well, I'm convinced even more that this connection to an evil empire from long ago is not only plausible, but entirely possible. Think of how much our world has changed since 9/11. The trillions of dollars that have been spent on so-called security, the invasions, the wars, the deaths, the coup d'etats, the suffering and refugees and revolution. And then here at home, of course, the rise of the national security state. We've all just sort of rolled over and let it happen. Mass surveillance, huge data banks collecting and listening to and collecting every phone call, every email, sticking it away for sorting it out later. The ridiculous measures at airports that seem to stop little old ladies from getting on planes with bottles of lotion, hand lotion, but never seem to stop the truly dedicated terrorists, as witnessed in Egypt this past week. Who benefits from all this change? That's the theme explored in this new work by Joseph Farrell, and we jump into the thick of it in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph Farrell is a scholar. He's got a PhD in philosophy from the University of Oxford. Listeners to this program know that he is a writer, researcher, historian who casts a very wide net. He's written about Nazi Germany, sacred literature, physics, finances, the Giza pyramids, music theory. He's a guy who assimilates a tremendous amount of material and then condenses it into concise conclusions that are hard to ignore, and we're thrilled to welcome him back to the program. Joseph, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back on, George.
Well, this is a lot to absorb. The new book, Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery. I mean, let's start it this way. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just mentioning in the previous segment about how the world has changed since 9/11.
Right.
Not much of it for the better.
No. You don't have to go very far to see, you know, evidence of a kind of creeping fascism going on, particularly in Western countries. You know, we've got cameras all over the place in the United Kingdom. We've got cameras on every stoplight in the United States. Plus, you know, the surveillance that we've been under since 9/11 itself. So you don't have to go very far.
You know, you mentioned early in this book that you had a feeling after 9/11, you started doing the research, you had sort of a feeling where it was going to lead, but you didn't really want it to be true. Am I stating that right?
Yeah, you're putting that exactly. So like many people, I was watching 9/11. I had just come home from work, and I had company staying with me at the time, and just as I was going to bed, he was waking up and coming out of the guest room and turning on the news, and I'm dozing off, and I hear, oh, my God, coming from the living room. And, you know, I got up and put on my bathrobe and came out and said, what's going on? And he pointed to the TV screen and said, look. And just as I look, within I'd say, a few very brief minutes, the second plane hit the South Tower. And at that point, you know, I thought, well, one plane might be coincidence, two is an attack. And so I stayed up watching 9/11 unfold, and as I was watching, I began to think that something is not right here. You can't coordinate this kind of an attack, particularly on the Pentagon, without some involvement of what I call level two in the book, without some involvement of the American deep state. But there were other aspects of 9/11 that began to disturb me. You know, President Bush gave his talk at Emma Booker Elementary School in Sarasota after he had been apprised of the situation and came out and said, well, America appears to be under some sort of terrorist attack, and I'm flying immediately back to Washington. Then, of course, once he gets to Air Force One, he doesn't fly back to Washington. He flies to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana, and then from there on up to Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha. And I thought, well, you know, that's wrong. There's something else going on here, because Barksdale is the backup command center for America's nuclear forces, and Offutt is the command center for them. So that clued me in that something was wrong. He gave that now, I think, crucial talk at Barksdale before departing there for Offutt, in which the terrorism narrative doesn't even appear. There's no mention of terrorism. All that he referred to is tests and attacks. And then, you know, we heard later that Vice President Cheney had been in the White House Situation Room. And all of this began to look to me that there was an operation here that may have been planned at some level within some rogue network within the American deep state, but that it had gone wrong. And I began thinking on the day of 9/11 itself, George, that we might in fact be looking at a three-tiered operation instead of a two-tiered operation like most of the 9/11 truth community has come to hold.
So let's talk about let's set the sort of the format for the next couple of hours, what you mean to the three tiers. The first tier being the obvious one that we all have been told is true. Muhammad right. Atta and his merry band of terrorists hijacked these planes, flying them into the World Trade Center and then into the Pentagon.
Right.
What's level two?
The second level reveals itself if you look at the 9/11 research very carefully. The second level in their research reveals itself in a kind of interesting chronological pattern, because the first thing that you notice happening in the 9/11 truth community after the events is, of course, they begin to pick apart the story. And one of the first things they focused on were all of the alerts that had been given to the United States from various other countries around the world. And it's quite a list. You have the United Kingdom, you have France, you have Germany, you have Russia, Israel, Egypt, I think even at one point the Taliban of all...
Yeah, Afghanistan.
...gave a warning to the United States that there would be these attacks. And the 9/11 truth community focused on this aspect and began to elaborate a hypothesis that was very clear that we had been warned. It was very clear that some of these warnings went all the way up to the White House itself, the British warning in particular, and the warnings from Russia as well in particular went all the way up to the White House. President Putin came out and said that he had personally tried to alert the United States that something was going to happen. And I hope we'll get back at some point in our discussion tonight to the Russian warning, because it's a huge part of the story. But the 9/11 truth community on this basis began to elaborate the hypothesis, and there were a number of very serious journals in Europe as well that made basically the same claim, that the events of 9/11 could not have happened unless they were allowed to have happened. In other words, you had the so-called LIHOP hypothesis, L-I-H-O-P, that stands for let it happen on purpose. So that became kind of the early functioning theory of the 9/11 truth community, and that indicated to them a kind of a deep layer involved in the events of a network of people in the United States. Most of them identified that layer as the neocon element within the State Department, the Pentagon, and so on and so forth. But then, as you look at the 9/11 research, something very interesting begins to happen circa, I'd say, 2003, 2004, sometime in that time frame. And that is, a number of researchers began to uncover the fact there were an enormous number of concurrent military and FAA drills on 9/11 that mirrored in almost exact fashion various aspects of what actually occurred on 9/11. There were drills where false radar blips were put into the FAA traffic control computers, gaming out scenarios of hijacked airplanes being crashed into American buildings. There were drills for similar attacks on the National Reconnaissance Office. There were drills, one of the most significant sets of drills were security stripping the United States of its military assets in the operational theater of 9/11 in the Northeast. A number of aircraft of the Air Force were stationed in Alaska and so on and so forth. So you had security stripping. And on top of this, you had what I find the most spectacular and disturbing drills were drills concerned with total military nuclear drills. All of our nuclear forces were on high alert on 9/11 as a part of a drill to game out, you know, staged attacks from Russia and so on and so forth. So when you add all these drills together, the 9/11 truth community began to realize that we have here a case of the JFK assassination all over again. You have security stripping, only in this case, the security stripping is of the entire country, and a number of drills are being run concurrently that, in the actual case of what happened, served to confuse the command and control structure. So they began to think in terms of the so-called MIHOP hypothesis. Dr. Webster Tarpley has been an advocate of that hypothesis for a number of years on the basis of some very solid research that he's done. And this is, of course, the made it happen on purpose. In other words, that there was an element of the American deep state, a rogue network, what have you, that actually was involved in the planning of the entire operation. There were just too many drills being run concurrent for this not to have been the case. So I kind of accept that premise and go from there and re-examine a number of things about 9/11 that suggest that there may have been a third component that turned the whole operation inside out. In other words, that turned it against level two. So that's my third layer, that there's another player that enters the stage and makes its presence known on 9/11. And Tarpley and some other researchers, Thierry Messon in France, have pointed out a number of clues that indicate that third layer.
You know, you mentioned JFK, and early in the book, you go into it how strikingly similar the circumstances are. When you look at the kind of things that were set in motion in advance of and during the JFK assassination, surrounding it, and looking at it from this perspective of years later, an historical perspective, you can't help but think, gosh, that's really weird. And then when you list the number of things, as you just did, that were in play, it's too much to be coincidental.
Right, it is. It's too much to be coincidental. And the reason for mentioning the parallels with JFK, let me just mention two of them. I've already referred to the security stripping aspects of some of these drills. But the other one is there are an unusual amount of doubles in play. There appear to be doubles, perhaps even triples for Mohammed Atta. There are a few for some of the other alleged hijackers and so on. And of course, this was clearly in evidence with JFK, with double and triple Oswalds, you know, Oswald being in New Orleans at the same time another Oswald is showing up at the Cuban embassy in Mexico City. So these things are clear indicators of deep state operation, of people that have knowledge and competence in covert operations and so on and so forth. So the patterns are, as you say, they're more than coincidental. They do point to some element within the American national security establishment.
Let's talk about the 9/11 community.
Right.
Were you at all reluctant to dive into this? Because, I mean, you admitted it, you stated in the book that this is a highly segmented community. There are turf wars, as in the UFO world.
Right.
people who stake out a position and they will defend it almost to the death. And anybody who has a contrary opinion is the enemy.
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, George. I was very reluctant. I have followed the community for quite a few years. And one of the things that really strikes me about it, particularly when you get into discussions of the mechanisms of the destruction of the Twin Towers, of which I think there are primarily four, when you look at the ongoing discussions in that community, the vitriol that is out there of proponents of one theory towards proponents of another is almost unbelievable. It's reduced itself to name-calling, to ad hominem attacks, to arguments from authority, and so on and so forth. And no one seems to be willing to sit back and look at those mechanism theories and realize that they might be looking at more than one player. And this is where I think the utility of this hypothesis of three possible players, two being very deep players, comes into play. Because it's entirely possible to have one group using one mechanism to destroy the Twin Towers and another group using another and signaling its presence thereby. So I think, you know, if you sit back and look at all of those mechanisms objectively, you have to admit that each of them has their strengths and each of them has their weaknesses. So I was, from that point of view, very reluctant.
The thing is, you know, if the scenario is accurate, if what you're describing, this level three a group of operatives is accurate, they're pretty good at this stuff. I mean, it's not simplistic.
No, it's not simplistic. And this is what we do need to understand. Even on the hypothesis of most 9/11 truth researchers, you have a deep player that's involved, a second tier player that's involved, that's very competent, that's very expert in carrying out false flag operations in conducting this type of covert operation. So, yeah, I think when you really put all the chips together and connect all the dots, you're looking at very, very sophisticated players, particularly at that third level. I think, you know, the cumulative effect of the book is that once you realize that there may be a third player, you realize how very, very competent and slick they really were.
Well, once you look at it in that framework, things really start to make some sense. I want to ask you if you have seen any fingerprints, disinformation from government operatives, maybe from level two people, if not level three people.
Well, I think that there was a certain amount of disinformation. One of the key areas there is when you look at the financial aspects of 9/11, there is almost to this day, a continued reluctance to delve very deeply into that area on the part of the government. The Securities and Exchange Commission, for example, when it suspended the rules of securities clearing on 9/11 and then subsequently became part of the investigations of 9/11, it deputized everybody, basically, that was involved with those investigations. And what that means is they can't talk. So there certainly has been, I think, a certain amount of dissembling. We've heard in the news recently about this classified 28-page document that the government is still reluctant to release. Many people speculate, and I think to a degree correctly, that Saudi Arabia is named as one of the principal players at that deep level two level. Behind 9/11. But the thing there, again, that we have to remember, and I point this out in the book, is that Senator Bob Graham, former senator from Florida, was at the time chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he's come out and done a number of interviews advocating the release of this document. But interestingly enough, he says that the contents are not only explosive, but that they reveal the role, the hidden role of foreign governments
plural.
In the operation of nine. Yeah, plural. So in other words, there's something else behind the obvious candidate here of Saudi Arabia behind 9/11. And that in and of itself, to my mind, seems to suggest a level three player is involved, and they don't want to complicate the narrative anymore with release of that document and that information.
Well, Joseph Farrell, we'll pick up the conversation on the other side. I realize there is plenty of disinformation in the early stages. I'm curious whether there's continuing disinformation within the 9/11 community, whether there are any of these researchers who spin things as operatives in order to confuse matters. We're going to get into that in a moment. We're going to take a break here on Coast to Coast AM. Sarah Evans, Born to Fly, her first big hit, takes us into the break. The Animals Don't Bring Me Down. They're a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame band on tour right now. In fact, coming to Las Vegas next weekend. I might have to go check that out. We're talking with Joseph Farrell about an amazing, jaw-dropping new book, Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery, The Fascist International, 9/11, and Penetrated Operations, a thorough review of the 9/11 evidence, a look at this conspiracy and alternative version of history in a way that no one has quite done before. We pick up the conversation right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph Farrell, I don't want to beat this to death, but I want to go back to the question about disinformation. Whether you've seen any inkling of sort of official stirring the pot, muddying the waters, I'm sure that, you know, to some extent, the 9/11 community is quite capable of muddying the waters all on its own, these turf wars and things of that sort. But any indications from you that something more sophisticated is going on, that somebody is sowing confusion or purposely stirring the pot?
Well, of course, the thing that springs most immediately to mind in the aftermath of 9/11 was the weapons of mass destruction meme that the Bush administration put out for the invasion of Iraq. As it turns out, we went in, we didn't find any evidence of weapons of mass destruction, at least of a standard variety that normal people would think of, you know, atomic or biological or chemical weapons and so on. I think that's one element. As far as the research itself goes, I deliberately tried to avoid in the book getting into those disputes of elaborate turf wars that have been going on in the 9/11 truth community. I tried to take pretty much a synthetic approach to the research that's out there and to look at certain things that they've uncovered. Now, that said, early on in the aftermath of 9/11, they did a number of television interviews with the fellow that owned the Huffman Aviation Flight School in Venice, Florida, a Dutchman by the name of Rudy Dekkers. And he for a brief period was kind of the darling of the media. He was kind of the darling of the establishment because, you know, owning that flight school, he was in contact with Muhammad Atta and so on and so forth. But he definitely tried to paint Atta in a negative way as a result of that. But when you dig deeper into that flight school and into the connections that he himself had and the connections that Atta maintained at that flight school, it's there that you begin to see some of the first glimmers or suggestions of a possible third layer involved on 9/11.
Let's talk about the level one folks. You know, as you mentioned in the book, Muhammad Atta and a couple of those, the conspirators allegedly were here in Las Vegas, among other places, partying, right, going to strip clubs.
Right.
You make a pretty good case in this book that they did not behave as your typical devoted Islamic jihadists.
No.
So make the case.
Well, it's kind of hard to equate, you know, a devout Muslim going to places like that, and there are further stories that a magnificent researcher into that aspect of the 9/11 story, a fellow by the name of Douglas Hopsicker, published a book called Welcome to Terrorland, in which he just basically examines their Florida stay. And he uncovered all sorts of evidence that Atta and company were, you know, traveling up and down the length and breadth of the state of Florida, again, visiting strip bars, holding drug parties and alcohol parties and cocaine parties and marijuana parties. And then to top all this, Muhammad Atta, you know, some of the evidence that was purportedly found in the abandoned car that he rented to drive from Boston up to Portland to make that connecting flight from Portland back to Boston to get on the American Airlines flight that hits the North Tower. in that he leaves a last will and testament, and the beginning of this thing, if you know anything about Islamic theology, it's hardly Islamic in any version, fundamentalist or otherwise. This testament begins in the name of God, which of course any pious Muslim would do, but then goes on to say, and my family. Well, you know, no Muslim is going to invoke the name of God in any breath with any human being, even the Prophet Muhammad. So, you know, there are a number of suspicious things about Muhammad Atta, but the most interesting thing, as far as I'm concerned, is that most of his close associates, while he was at the Huffman Aviation School in Florida, appeared to have been Dutch and German. He was visited constantly by people with names like Wolfgang and Peter and, you know, Jürgen and so on and so forth. And, you know, when you see that, the suspicion meter begins to rise a bit. You know, what's this guy hanging out with a bunch of Dutchmen and Germans and in some cases Swiss Germans? This changes the complexion of the man completely. And on top of this, he appeared to have been getting funding from some source inside of Germany. He appeared to have been connected in some way or fashion to intelligence. There was a case of him being interviewed by Czech intelligence. He spoke French. He spoke German fluently. He spoke Hebrew, in fact. So, you know, this is a very unusual dossier, a very unusual resume for someone that's supposedly a fundamentalist Islamic terrorist.
And basically, the picture you paint, it finally dawns on people as you're reading this book, is that Atta is Oswald. I mean, Atta is like an Oswald-like person who is, he's an operative.
Yes, exactly. Let's look at that a little bit closer, because the whole idea, let's just stop and think for a moment. The whole idea, if you're going to try and pull off a coordinated terrorist attack with several airplanes being hijacked and slamming into American targets, would you risk the operation by renting a car in Boston, driving to Portland, Maine, and then boarding a connecting flight back to Boston so that you can then board an American Airlines flight and crash it into the North Tower of the World Trade Center? Well, you know, from any operational standpoint of view, the answer is no. You wouldn't risk the operation going wrong, or a component of it going wrong, by such a procedure. And the other thing is that Atta takes along supposedly a bunch of luggage, which conveniently does not get loaded onto the flight, but is discovered by the FBI in that rented car. The luggage conveniently contains things like Islamic fundamentalist literature and so on and so forth, his last will and testament, as I mentioned. So this has all the hallmarks to me of another Lee Harvey Oswald being sheep-dipped by intelligence. And let's add one more thing to that portfolio. Mohammed Atta is the name also of the famous school bus bombing that took place in Israel. I think it was the year 1986. So in other words, that name would have been put on a national security watch list for anyone coming into this country with that name. And the very fact that he gets into this country coming from Hamburg, Germany, means that there had to have been in place, most probably, some sort of national security override. So in other words, if you look at Atta closely, he appears to be, you know, someone that has the fingerprints of intelligence all over him.
So he's posing as a terrorist. He's living it up. He's living like some, you know, doing things that a Islamic jihadist would not. He gets into the country, even though he has this name that should have spiked all kinds of warnings even back then.
Right.
And he leaves a luggage conveniently that has all kinds of incriminating stuff that point to him as a terrorist.
Right.
Luggage doesn't get put on the plane. It really looks like a setup. And then, of course, you think that there's a suggestion that there are multiple Attas.
Yeah, the very fact that you have that Israeli school bus bombing with someone of the same name is already a case of a double Atta that already has a terrorist connection. And then there are other instances of Mohammed Atta in attendance at one of the military flight schools in Alabama. So, you know, how many Mohammed Attas are we dealing with here? By my count, we're looking at three. And in that respect, we have, you know, we have yet another pattern that connects it to the JFK assassination, and therefore, I think, a pattern indicative to a certain extent of some rogue element within the American deep state. So yeah, you have that fingerprint, but the most sensational fingerprint, and I'm trying to watch the time here for the break, is
Oh, we're good.
something,
You're good.
4 minutes?
Yeah, sure.
The most sensational element, George, that I found that raised my suspicion meter right into the red zone was the fact that Otto was recruited in Cairo by two anonymous Germans. He learns German, he goes to Germany, he spends a number of years living in a middle-class residential area of Hamburg, Germany, and from there, of course, he makes his way to the United States and joins this flight school in Venice, Florida. But while he's in Germany, he's sponsored by a society that has, it's kind of a joint German Bundestag U.S. Congress program for students from underdeveloped countries. And the actual formal sponsoring agency is a German society called the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft. And when I read that, my suspicion meter went into the red zone immediately because I knew who Karl Duisberg is. And most of the 9/11 truth community, those that do mention this, without exception, but one case, there is one exception, but most don't even understand or appreciate the significance of that name. Karl Duisberg was the CEO during World War I and after of the German chemicals company Bayer. And I heard your story about Bayer wanting to buy Monsanto. So,
right. That's a great combo, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great combo. Well, Bayer and Karl Duisberg was one of the founding people, one of the guiding lights, one of the financial geniuses that was behind the founding of the German cartel IG Farben. So, you know, you've got this weird connection of Mohammed Atta to a German society named after one of the founders of IG Farben. And they list him during his years in Germany as a visiting scholar, as a kind of a tutor. So presumably he was getting some sort of stipend from this group. So you put that together with his association in Florida with Rudy Dekkers and a bunch of Dutchmen and a bunch of Germans. And it's beginning to look very, very different than the official story.
IG Farben, of course, a sort of a bedrock conglomerate behind the Nazi war machine.
Yeah, when you say IG Farben, you're essentially saying Nazi war machine, yeah. And it's important for people to remember something that I bring out in one of my other books, The Nazi International. IG Farben was not formally liquidated, completely formally liquidated, until the year 2003. So in other words, that cartel continued to exist on the books. Its stock was even still traded for quite a while after the war. So in other words, you're looking at a connection here that is very suspicious. Now, I'm not saying it proves anything. I'm saying it simply is possibly indicative of a much larger pattern. And there's other things in the book that tend to cement that relationship a little bit more concretely.
We still have 5 minutes before the break, so let's talk a bit about the flight school in Florida. You bring up some really interesting stuff about the flight school and connections there. I'll let you tell that part of the story.
Well, the flight school, it turns out, if you dig into Rudy Dekkers and so on, and this Douglas Hopsicker does an absolutely supremely good job of in his book, if you dig into Rudy Dekkers, you discover that he was involved, and under investigation by the DEA, incidentally, that he was involved in smuggling activities, apparently, and that some of these smuggling activities allegedly involved smuggling computer chips. In other words, high technology. He had the DEA investigation, and in addition to this, he was also apparently, allegedly, smuggling aircraft. And the way he was doing this was that he was apparently smuggling, this smuggling activity was over the Arctic Circle. And when I read that, I just thought, no, you've got to be kidding. Because, of course, that's one of the most heavily monitored areas by the world's military, the United Kingdom, Canada, the United States, Russia. That's one of the most heavily monitored areas in the world. So in other words, one of two things has to be happening here. They either have to have supremely skilled pilots flying these planes extremely low underneath the radar, or they have to be flying with the tacit permission or knowledge of at least some of those countries and their military command structures. I mean, there's no two ways to slice this. So Deckers and that flight school are involved in something huge. Add to that the strange associations of Otto while he's there with all of these Dutchmen and Germans, and you have a very, very different picture. This is a man that, to my mind, has all the classical signs of some intelligence connection. We don't know exactly who, but of some intelligence connection written all over him, absolutely.
This kind of smuggling operation, it reminds you of CIA-connected planes smuggling huge shipments of cocaine from Central America and arms deals and raising money that's off the books.
Yeah, well, there's even, it's interesting that you mention that, George, because there's even a connection of Rudy Deckers and his Huffman Aviation, and I forget exactly what it is. It's kind of a loose, threadbare connection to that very activity. Some of his pilots allegedly involved in that activity also knew Barry Seal, the famous pilot that was found dead, you know, allegedly involved with smuggling drugs into Mena, Arkansas, and involved with Iran-Contra and so on and so forth. So, yeah, this is beginning to look like an operation that has some connection via ATA to this global network, global fascist mafia, whatever you want to call it, that is involved deeply with international criminal underground activity.
Characterize for me what you have learned about the capabilities of these so-called terrorist pilots getting all this training at these obscure schools. How good students?
Well, this is the other aspect that the 9/11 truth community has focused on, because the pilots, you know, Hani Hanger with American 77 supposedly executing that descending spiral turn and then coming screaming in at ground level into the Pentagon. You know, the Egyptian president Hosni Mubarak was a former pilot and was on American TV shortly after 9/11 and came right out and said that, you know, any pilot able to execute that maneuver would have to be extremely skilled. Well, Hani Hanger, as most 9/11 truth researchers will tell you, was a pilot not known for his piloting skills. And this pretty much is true of all of the alleged pilots. They weren't very good pilots, according to the people that actually instructed them. So again, this raises the bar of exactly what's going on at 9/11. Who was piloting, if anyone, those aircraft? Were they remote controlled? You know, there's all sorts of theories out there. But as far as the hijackers themselves are concerned, they didn't appear to be all that skilled, especially to make that descending spiral turn over the Pentagon to crash that flight into the Pentagon, if indeed it was the airplane. You know, that's the other aspect of this story that gets very murky. But yeah, these guys are, to my mind, George, they're classical patsies. There's just really no other way to look at this. And once you've said patsies, then you're dealing with a classic false flag operation. You've got the involvement of some rogue group that has deep competence in these types of things, and that spells intelligence.
You think that Otta and his crew thought they were working for elements of the U.S. government, that they knew they were operatives for someone? Do you think they thought it was the level two guys in the government?
I tend to disagree with those 9/11 researchers out there that think that, for the simple reason that you have this very strange German connection to ATA, and that connection looks more like a connection to an unknown global network, in other words, to my level three or tier three part of the operation. I think that, plus the fact that ATA has the associations that he does in Florida, not only with Rudy Deckers, but some of these other people that I've mentioned, I think that ATA probably saw himself as an agent for that group. Now, he may have been told that he was working for the Americans or, you know, the Russians or Saudis or whatever, but ultimately I don't think he was working for any of those. He may to have to a certain extent have been clueless as to who his ultimate handlers really were.
Joseph Farrell is my guest. The new book, Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery. We're getting into the good stuff now. Mamas and the Papas covering a Beatles song, I Call Your Name. Take us into the break.